Chapter 27. Sharp lived in a townhouse at 454 Huron Place on Staten Island. Checking the duty roster, Sarah learned that Sharp was moonlighting as a security guard at Hecht Gardens. Nothing wrong with that. Plenty of cops did it. It spoke to his enthusiasm. The guy was willing to spend his off hours looking for perps. Might as well get paid for it. At 5, she left her desk, donned her jacket, backpack, unlocked her bike, and put on her helmet. Sharp's bike was already gone. At 5 o'clock on a June afternoon, Manhattan resembled a giant puzzle, like one of those sliding checkerboards filled with letters, one missing. In other words, gridlock. Traffic moved in tiny increments, inching here, honking there, gesturing and threatening everywhere. Sarah took full advantage of her bike, splitting lanes, cutting corners, even riding on the sidewalk when necessary, fighting her way south to the tip of the island and the Staten Island ferry. Sarah walked her bike into the hold, setting the kickstand between two vinyl-wrapped pillars. She wished Yamaha would wise up and put center stands on all their sport bikes. The silly little kickstands almost seemed designed to fail. Sarah decided to stay with her bike rather than mingle. Smelling of the sea, the hold conducted a discordant symphony of squeaks and groans. Faint odor of deep-fried clams trickled down from the concessionaires. She needn't have worried. The ferry was steady as bedrock and her bike hardly shifted at all, not even when the ferry slugged the pier 45 minutes later. Sarah put her helmet on before zipping between the cars to the front of the line. She was first off once the ramp was lowered. She was gone by the time the first car hit the pavement. She'd already found the appropriate map of Staten Island, mounted it in the clear plastic pouch atop her tank bag with Sharp's address circled. 15 minutes later, she found it, a new development on its own dead-end circle, neat little two-story townhouses, each with its own attached one-car garage. Although the houses were planted cheek by jowl, they were designed in such a way as to give the illusion of privacy. Sarah tucked her bike right into Sharp's alcove and locked the front wheel. She doubted she needed extra precautions. Staten Island was an island of calm in a sea of crime. Although no one was watching, Sarah went through the motions of knocking on the door and ringing the buzzer. Nada. She placed her right hand on the knob. Immediately above it was a deadbolt. Breathing deeply to relax, she channeled her energy into her right hand, willing the witchblade to rise, to congregate at the tips of her fingers. It seemed to have a mind of its own, but it often anticipated and acted in Sarah's interests. This was different. This time her life was not in danger. She formed a mental image of the door swinging inward. There was a tingling on her wrist, and when she looked down, her hand was buried in a metal apparatus. It might have been a glove, but the index finger extended, by dogleg and kink, into the keyhole and the deadbolt. There was a click and the door swung inward. Sarah slipped inside, shut the door, and stood with her back to it, trying to still the rush of blood in her ears. She was breathing hard. She had just committed breaking and entering. Other cops, sad to say, could commit felonies without blinking an eyelash. There were tons of studies comparing the psychology of cops and criminals, finding them similar. Not Sarah. For as long as she could remember, she had a burning need to right wrongs. Not that a mere technical felony put her in a fainting spell. But it was against a fellow cop, someone she liked and admired, and she wasn't used to breaking the law. Gradually, her beating heart stilled and she listened. She extended her hearing throughout the cool, silent house. Not entirely silent. She heard the compressor in the refrigerator, the whoosh of air through the ventilation system, the tick of an old clock in the living room. She looked down. She wore high-topped Adidas black sneakers. Safe enough. She wore a latex glove on her left hand. Except for the kitchenette, the first floor was carpeted and consisted of a high-ceiling living room looking out on a tiny, fence-enclosed back patio. There were two stone Japanese lanterns on plinths in the backyard, along with a tiny koi pond. Sarah would have bet money there were fish in the pond. The living room was sparely but elegantly decorated with Japanese brush paintings, a Hiroshige print, and a couple of black and white Ansel Adams prints of the Grand Canyon. And of course the swords. There they were, mounted on a credenza, without so much as a plexiglass case or man-eating tiger to protect them. A wakizashi and a tanto. Sarah could tell they were valuable just by looking at them. The hilt was wrapped in reiskin, and finished in leather wrapping. The silver manuki depicted a fish. Sarah held her hands in front of the paired swords, as if warming them by a fire. "What's happening here?" she whispered to the witchblade. "Did one of these kill those men?" The witchblade was silent. The downstairs bathroom was tidy and held no surprises, nor the kitchen. Sarah used only the gloved left hand in opening drawers and cupboards. Sharp had a couple bottles of sake socked away, otherwise appeared to be a teetotaler. She crept carefully up the stairs to the second floor. There were two bedrooms and a bath. Sharp used one of the bedrooms for his office. It was here Sarah found the safe. It was a full-size Sheffield, tucked into the closet, and it was locked. Sarah scanned the office first. A desk, with a computer. How she would have loved to boot it up and try and get in, but that would have left a record, one a clever cop could easily discover. The Witchblade didn't do computers. Photo of a man taped to the shelf, style and dude with California hair, tennis whites, grinning like a box of Wheaties. Carefully, using her gloved hand, Sarah removed it and turned it over. To the samurai, from Surfer Dude. No signature. There was a leather address book on the desk. Sarah went methodically through it. Most of the entrants were old, and lived in California. One was circled three times. Ralph Munster. Ralph at work, Justine, and Associates, Old Line Wall Street Investments. Sharp's banker pal. She found his card lying on the desktop and took it. She put the photo back. She leafed through the stack of papers on the desk. Mostly police work, plus some correspondence with pals, none of it of much interest. Copies of the New Yorker and Law Enforcement Monthly. Burning with impatience, she forced herself to go methodically through the contents of the desk. There was nothing that would connect the tall cop to the samurai killings other than his oriental tastes. She even checked the titles on his bookshelf, pulling out each volume to look for hidden compartments. Finally, she turned her attention to the safe. It was 6 feet tall and made of reinforced, carbonized steel, dark green with the Sheffield logo painted in old-fashioned gold leaf script on the front. Planting her feet at shoulder width, Sarah willed herself to relax and extended her right hand. Her palm immediately began to tingle, as if she'd slapped it hard against a flat surface. Her hand flew to the dial of its own volition, abruptly encased in shiny metal. Whatever was in the safe, it beckoned to the Witchblade and vice versa. She turned the tumblers like a kid playing table hockey. Click, 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 the thing unlocked. She pulled the heavy door toward her on silent, well-oiled hinges. Her eyes settled first on the guns. The black nylon stock of the AR-15, the bulldog body of the Heckler & Koch MP5A3, the pistol-stocked Ithaca pump-action 12-gauge. Ethra Sharp was a serious collector or he was planning an insurrection. Sarah knew a lot of cops were gun nuts, but Sharp hadn't seemed the type. For some reason, she felt a vague disappointment. Next to the guns, held vertically in place by a series of foam brackets, were six long narrow bundles wrapped in plain burgundy silk. Sarah knew what she would find even before she unwrapped the first bundle. A spasm of apprehension had settled in her neck, but her hand was alive with a mind of its own. She had to restrain it from unwrapping the bundle too fast. She set the bundle flat on the floor of the office and unwrapped it carefully. And there it was. A long sword, a daito, housed in a black lacquered wood scabbard, with mountings through two rings. There were four bundles counting the one on the floor. A string of obscenities bubbled from her lips. Not a cop. Not Sharp. It was all circumstantial, unless she could match one of Sharp's blades to one of the missing swords, or somehow match striations produced by one of his blades to the neck wounds of the victims. Carefully, she grabbed the sword by the handle and the scabbard and drew it partway out. Even in the pale evening light, the blade gleamed and shimmered like a thing alive. Unfortunately, she knew from David that the blade's creator had signed his name on the tang, beneath the wrappings. The sword's peg seemed to be buried beneath the ancient silk handle wrapping and she didn't want to risk damaging the several hundred-year-old handle to take a look. She doubted her ability to render the Japanese characters accurately. The best she could do would be to make detailed notes of the blade's appearances, and see if they matched descriptions of the stolen swords. She kicked herself for not bringing a camera. Then what? How could she introduce evidence and get a search warrant? Sharp was completely above suspicion. He was a cop. She was committing a felony by tossing his apartment. Working swiftly, she unwrapped each blade and made a series of detailed descriptions in her notepad, including sketching the handles and the points. None were stone flower. She drew with her right hand, which again behaved as if it had a mind of its own. Her drawings were uncannily neat and accurate. She knew points were all important in determining a blade's origin. She was extremely careful not to touch any part of the blade itself, and not to let the blade touch the ground. She pointed the tip of the blade toward the light and peered at it from the pommel, as David had taught her. She balanced the blades carefully on a book to lift them off the floor while she sketched. Finally, she returned all the blades to where they had been, in the proper order. There was a safe within the safe, a recessed wall cabinet. She opened the door and found a Glock 45 inside with a barrel-mounted laser, typical macho toy, and a series of manila envelopes. She took out a manila envelope, opened the unsealed end, and shook out a series of 8x10 black and white glossies. A man clad in S&M leather, studded dog collar, zippered face mask, more belts and straps than a gladiator, chained spread-eagled to a bed. Sarah felt a lurch, as if her plane had hit a vacuum, a sickening feeling in the pit of her stomach. She looked at the rest. They were similar. Some were worse. Some involved foreign objects being inserted into various places. She told herself it could be crime evidence. She told herself some men had harmless fantasies. But she could not tell herself that the man chained and shackled in one of the photographs wasn't Sharp, and if that was him, someone else was taking the picture.